as well as it that pulls us. It's us tacking and involuting through the airspace, the shifts in it we call tides. Civilians, even those awake not puking or weeping, can't do that. The fact is, a lot of the bullshit we tell you about the Immer is true. We're still playing you when we tell you the story dramatizes even without lying. This is the third universe, I told Sile. There have been two others before this, right? I didn't know how much civilians knew. This stuff had become my common sense. Each one was born different. It had its own laws. In the first one, they reckon light was about twice as fast as it is here now. Each one was born and grew and got old and collapsed. Three different sometimes. But below all that, or around it, or whatever, there's only ever been one Immer. One always. He did know all that, it turned out. But to be told these everyday facts by an immerser made them something new, and he listened like a boy. We were in a bad hotel on the outskirts of Pelusius, a small city popular with tourists because of the gorgeous magma falls it straddles. It's the capital of a small country on a world the name of which I don't remember. In the everyday, it's not in our galaxy. It's off somewhere light eons away. But it and Dagostein are close neighbours via the Immer. By then I was seasoned enough. I'd been to many places. I was between commissions when I met Sile, spending a couple of local weeks on self-granted shore leave before I went for another job. I was picking up rumours of new Immertech, exploration, dubious missions. The hotel bar was full of immersers and other port life, travellers recovering, and, this time, academics. I was pretty familiar with all but the last of these types. In the lobby was an ad for a course in the healing power of story, at which I made rude noises. A trid of turning and altering words floated the corridors, welcoming guests to the inaugural meeting of the Gold and Silver Circuits Board, to a convocation of Shirasi philosopher bureaucrats, to CHEL, the Conference of Human Exoter Linguists. I was drunk in the bar with a bunch of temporary stopover friends, all now thoroughly hazy memories. We were being obnoxious. I went from half-heartedly flirting with a bartender to mocking a table of scholars from CHEL, no less drunk or boisterous than we. We'd eavesdropped on them, and then told them with immerser swagger that they didn't know anything about life or even languages in the out, and so on. "Go on, then. Ask me something," I said to Sile. That was the first thing I ever said to him. I know exactly how I'd have looked, leaning back in my high chair, turned so resting my back against the bar top, my head back so I could look down at him. I was surely pointing at him with both hands, and smiling, a bit pinch-mouthed, so as not to yet give him any satisfaction. Sile was the least gone at his table, and he was refereeing the teasing on both sides. "I know all about weird languages," I told him. "More than any of you buggers. I'm from Embassy Town." When he believed me, I've never seen a man so astonished, so delighted. He didn't stop playing, but he looked at me very differently, the more when he discovered none of my companions were my compatriots. I was the only Embassy Towner, and Sile loved it. It wasn't just his attention I liked. I was pleased with how this compact, tough-looking guy fenced with me and kept everyone raucously amused while asking questions with actual content. We stumbled off after a while and spent a night and a day trying to enjoy sex together, sleeping, trying again, several times, with good-humoured lack of success. After that, over breakfast, he badgered and blandished and begged me, and I, pretending disdain and having a lovely time, acquiesced and let him take me, tired but, as I teased him, not sore enough, to the conference. He presented me to his colleagues. The CHEL was for the tear study of all exot languages, but it was those generally considered most strange that fascinated its members. I saw slapdash temporary trids advertising sessions on cross-cultural chromatophore signalling, on touch communication among the unseeing burden, and on me.
"I'm working in Homash. Do you know it?"
said one young woman to me, apropos of nothing. She was very happy when I told her no.
They speak by regurgitation, pellets embedded with enzymes in different combinations of sentences, which their interlocutors eat. I notice my own trid in the background. Embassy town a guest, on life among the Arieke. That's wrong, I told the conference organisers. They're hosts, but they told me, only to you. Sal's colleagues were eager to talk to me. No one there had met embassy towners before, nor hosts, of course. They're still quarantined, I told them. But in any case, they've never asked about coming out. We don't even know if they could take immersion. I was willing to be a curio, but I disappointed them. I'd warned Sile I would. The discussion became vague and sociological when they realised that I wouldn't be able to tell them almost anything about language. I hardly understand any, I said. We only learn a tiny bit, except staff and ambassadors. One participant pulled up some recordings of hosts speaking and ran through some vocabulary. I was pleased to be able to nuance a couple of the definitions, but honestly there are at least two people in the room who understood language better than I did. Instead, I told them stories of life in the outpost. They didn't know about the Aeoli, the air sculpting that kept a breathable dome over Embassy Town. A few had seen some bits of exported biorigging, but I could talk them through the out-of-date trids they had of the vaster infrastructure, the herds of houses, time-lapse of a young bridge maturing from its pontoon cell to link city regions for no reasons I could give. Sile asked me about religion, and I told him that so far as I knew, the hosts had none. I mentioned the festivals of lies. Sile was not the only one who wanted to pursue that. But I thought they couldn't, someone said. That's sort of the point, I said. To strive for the impossible. What are they like, those festivals? I laughed and said I'd no clue, had never been to one, of course, had never been into the host city. They began to debate language among themselves. Wondering how to repay their hospitality and anecdote, I told them what had happened to me in the abandoned restaurant. They were attentive all over again. Sile stared with his manic precision.
You were in a simile, they said.
I am a simile, I said.
You're a story.
I was glad to be able to give Sile something. He and his colleagues were more excited at my having been simile than I was. Sometimes I teased Sile that he only wanted me for my host's language, or because I'm part of a vocabulary. He'd finished the bulk of his research. It was a comparative study of a particular set of phonemes in several different languages, and not all of one species or one world, which made little sense to me. What are you looking for? I said.
Oh, secrets, he said. You know, essences, inherentnesses.
Bravo on that ugly word. And?
And there aren't any.
I said. Awkward.
That's to fetus talk. I'll cobble something together. A scholar can never let mere wrongness get in the way of the theory.
Bravo again. I toasted him. We stayed together in that hotel much longer than either of us had planned, and then I, having no plans and no commission, sought work on the vessel taking him a trade route home. I was experienced and well-referenced, and getting the job wasn't hard. It was only a short trip, 400 hours or some such. When I realised how bad was Sile's reaction to immersion, I was very touched that he chose not to travel in Sopor that first time together. It was a pointless gesture. He endured my shifts in lonely nausea, and despite meds, could hardly even speak to me when I was off duty. But even irritated at his condition, I was touched. From what I gathered, it wouldn't have taken very much for him to tidy up his last few chapters, the charts, sound files and trids. But Sile suddenly announced to me that he was not going to hand in his thesis. You've done all that work and you won't jump the last hoop, I said.
Sod it, he said,
flamboyantly unconcerned. He made me laugh.
The revolution stalled.
My poor, failed radical.
Yeah, well, I was bored.
But hold on. I tried to say, more or less. But are you serious? Surely it would be worth...
It's done. It's old news, forget it. I have other research projects anyway, simile. What are you like?
He bowed at that bad joke, clicked his fingers and moved us, thematically, on.
He kept asking about Embassy Town. His intensity was exciting, but he diluted it with enough self-mockery that I believed his sometimes obsessive demeanour was partly performance.
We didn't stay long in his parochial university town. He said he'd follow me and pester me until I gave in and took him I knew where. I didn't believe any of this, but when I got my next commission, he took transit with me, as a passenger. Once on that trip, when we were in shallow, calm Immer, I brought Sile out of Sopor to see a school of the Immer predators we call High. I've spoken to captains and scientists who don't believe them to be anything like life, only aggregates of Immer. Their attacks and jackknife precision, just the jostles of an Immer chaos in which our manchmal brains can't learn to see the deep random. Myself, I've always thought them monsters. Sile, fortified with drugs, and I watched our assertion charges shake the Immer and send the High darting. When we emerged, wherever we emerged, wherever our vessel had delivery or pickup, Sile would register at local libraries, picking at old research and starting his new project. Where there were sights, we saw them. We shared beds, but fairly quickly we gave up on sex. He learnt languages wherever we were, with his ferocious concentration, slang if he already knew the formal vocabulary. I'd travelled far more than he had, but I spoke and read only Anglo-Ubic. I was pleased by his company, often amused, always interested. I tested him, taking jobs that hauled us through Immer for hundreds of hours at a time. Nothing cruelly long, but long enough. He finally passed, according to my unclear emotional accounting, when I realised that I wasn't only watching to see if he'd stay, but was hoping he wouldn't leave. We were married on Duggustine, in Bremen, in Charo City, to where I'd sent my childish letters. I told myself, and it was true, that it was important for me to emerge in my capital port sometimes. Even at the dragged-out pace of interworld letter exchanges, Sile had corresponded with local researchers, and I, never a loner, had contacts in the quick intense friendships that come and go among immersers, so we knew we'd have a reasonable turnout. There in my national capital, which most embassy towners never saw, I could register with the union, download savings into my main account, amass news of Bremen jurisdiction. The flat I owned was in an unfashionable but pleasant part of the city. Around my house, I rarely saw anyone accoutremented with the silly luxury tech imported from embassy town. Being married under local law would make it easier for Sile to visit any of Bremen's provinces or holdings. I responded for a long time to his pestering fascination, never the joke he at first pretended, with the information that I'd no intention of returning to Embassy Town. But I think by the time we married, I was ready to give him the gift of taking him to my first home. It wasn't wholly straightforward. Bremen controlled entry to some of its territories, almost as carefully as it did egress. We were intending to disembark there, so I wasn't just signing up on a merchant run. At Transit House, perplexed officials sent me up a chain of authority. I'd expected that, but I was mildly surprised at how high, if my reading of office furniture as evidence wasn't on the fritz, the buck passing went.
"You want to go back to Embassy Town?"
a woman who must presumably have been only a rung or two down from the boss said.
"You have to realise that's unusual."
"So everyone keeps telling me."
"You miss home?"
"Hardly," I told her. "The things we do for love." I sighed theatrically, but she didn't want to play. It's not as if I relished the idea of being stuck so far from the hub. She met my look and did not respond. She asked me what I planned to do on Arieka, in Embassy Town. I told her the truth. "To Floak," I said. That didn't amuse her either. "To whom would I be reporting on arrival?" I told her no one. I was no one's subordinate there. I was a civilian. She reminded me that Embassy Town was a Bremen port. Where had I been since entering the out? Everywhere, she stressed, and who could remember that? I had to go through my carters and all my old dat swipes, though she must have known that at plenty of places such formalities of arrival were slapdash.
She read my list, including terminuses and brief stops I didn't remember at all. She asked me questions about the local politics of one or two, at which I could only smile, so ill-equipped was I to answer, and she stared at me as I burbled. I wasn't sure what she suspected me of. Ultimately, as a carter-carrying Embassy Town native immerser, crewing and vouching for my fiancé, it only took tenacity to get him the rights to entry, and me to re-entry. Sile had been preparing for his work there, reading, listening to recordings, watching what few trids and vids there are. He'd even decided on what the title of his book would be. "One shift only," I told him. "We're only going until the next relief." In Charo City, in a cathedral to Christ uploaded, which to my surprise he asked for, I married Sile according to Bremen law, in the second degree, registering as a non-connubial love match, and I took him to Embassy Town. Part 1. Income. Latter Day 1. Diplomacy Hall was jammed. It was usual for every ball, every greeting of leaving visitors, to be busy, but not like that night. It was hardly surprising. There'd been extraordinary anticipation. However much the staff might have insisted to us all that this was a regular arrival, they didn't even attempt to sound as if they believed it. I was jostled among the dress clothes. I wore jewels, and I activated a few augments that sent a corona of pretty lights around me. I leaned against the wall in the thick leaves. "Well, don't you look good?" Ursel had found me. Short hair, choppy, like it. "Did you say goodbye to Kaylee?" "I thank you, and I did indeed. I still can't believe she got the papers to leave." "Well," Ursel nodded to where Kaylee hung onto the arm of Damier, a staff woman partly responsible for Carter's. "I think she may have made a horizontal application." I laughed. Ursel was autumn. Her integument was adorned that night with acrylic peacock feathers, and trid jewellery orbited her. "I'm so tired," she said. She made her face crackle as if static interrupted it. "I'm just waiting to see our new ambassador in action. How can I not, really? And then I'm gone." She only ever used one corpus, according to some tearful sense of politesse or accommodation. I think she knew that having to relate to someone variably physically incarnate would trouble us. She was import, of course, though it wasn't clear where she'd come from or when. She'd been in Embassy Town for longer than the lifetime of anyone I knew. Her touring wear was way beyond local capabilities, and more than the equal of any I'd seen in the out. Spending time with most Autumner is like accompanying someone brutally cognitively damaged. But Ursel was a friend. "Come, save me from the village idiots," she sometimes said to me after downloading updates alongside other Autumner. "Do you joke to yourself when no one's watching?" I had asked her once. "Does it matter?" she had said at last, and I felt scolded. It had been rude and adolescent to raise the question of her personality, her apparent consciousness, of whether it was for my benefit. It was a tradition that none of the few Autumns whose behaviour was human enough to prompt the question would answer it. She was my best friend, and somewhat well-known, oddity that she was. When I met her, I was certain I had seen her before. I couldn't place it at first. Then when I realised what I thought the situation had been, I asked her abruptly, as if I could startle her, "What did they want you there for?" "At Bren's place, ages ago, when the ambassadors recited my simile to me. That was you, wasn't it? Remember?" "Arvis," she had said, gently reproving, and made her face shake as if disappointed. That was all I ever got from her on the matter, and I didn't push it. We huddled together by the indoor ivy and watched little cams flit around the room, recording. Decorative biorigging shed colours from carapaces. "Have you met them, then?" Ursel said. "The esteemed intake for whom we wait. I haven't." That surprised me. Ursel had no job, wasn't under the obligation of any tithe, but as a computer she was valuable to staff, and often acted for them. I would have said the same about me, that my inside-outside status had been useful to them, until I fell from favour. I'd have expected Ursel to be part of whatever discussions had been ongoing, but since the new ambassador had arrived, apparently, the staff had retreated into clique.
"There's tussling," Ursel said. "That's what I've heard."
People told Ursel things. Perhaps it was because she wasn't human, but was, almost. I think she also tapped into the local net, broke encryption on enough snips to be a good source of information to friends.
"People are worried, though I gather some have rather taken a shine. Watch Magdar. And now Wyatt's been insisting on getting involved."
"Wyatt?"
"He's been citing old laws, trying to brief the ambassador alone, thank you very much, that sort of thing."
Wyatt, the Bremen representative, had arrived with his small staff on the previous trade vessel to relieve Chettenham, his predecessor. He was scheduled to leave in one more tour's time. Bremen had established Embassy Town somewhat more than 2 mega-hours ago. We were all juridically Bremeny, protectees. But the ambassadors who governed formally in Bremen's name were born here, of course, as were staff and we who made up their canton. Wyatt, Chettenham, and other attachés on their lengthy postings relied on staff for trade information, for suggestions, for access to hosts and tech. It was rare for them to issue orders other than carry on. They were advisers to staff, too, useful for gauging the politics in the capital. I was intrigued that Wyatt was now interpreting his remit in so muscular a fashion. This was the first time in living memory that an ambassador had arrived from the out. Had the party not forced their hands, the ship was leaving and the ball couldn't be delayed, I suspected the staff would have tried to quarantine the new arrivals longer and continued with whatever their intrigues were.
"Calvin's here," Ursel warned quietly, her displayed face glancing over my shoulder.
I did not look round. She looked at me and made a little what face, telling me without words that she'd still like to know what had happened there sometime. I shook my head. Yana Suthel, Embassy Town's senior research scientist, arrived, and with her an ambassador. I whispered to Ursel.
"Good, it's Edgar. Time to schmooze. I'll report back in a bit."
I made it slowly through the crowd into the ambassador's orbit. There, in the middle of laughter, and buffeted a little by those dancing, I raised my glass and made Edgar face me.
"Ambassador," I said.
They smiled.
"So," I said, "are we ready?"
"Christ Pharos, no," said Ed, or Gar. "You ask as if I should know what's going on, Avis," said the other.
I inclined my head. Ed, Gar, and I had always enjoyed an exaggerated flirtation. They liked me. They were garrulous, gossips, always giving up as much as and a little more than they should. The dapper older men glanced side to side, raised eyebrows in theatrical alarm, as if someone might swoop in and stop them speaking. Their conspiratorialism was their shtick. They had probably been warned off me in the last few months, but they still treated me with a chatty courtesy I appreciated. I smiled, but hesitated when I realised that despite their party faces, they seemed genuinely unhappy.
"I wouldn't have thought it were possible," Edgar said. "There's things going on here that we don't understand."
"What about the rest of the ambassadors?" I said. We looked around the room. Many of their colleagues had arrived now. I saw Esme in iridescent dresses, Arnold fingering the tight collars wedged uncomfortable-looking below their links, Jasmine and Helene debating complexly, each ambassador interrupting the other, each half of each ambassador finishing their doppel's words. So many ambassadors in one place made for a dreamish feel. Socketed into their necks and variously ornamental, according to taste, diodes in their circuited links staccatoed through colours in simultaneous pairs.
"Honestly," said Edgar, "they're all worried, to various degrees. Some of them think we're exaggerating. Randolph thinks it'll all be good for us, to have a newcomer to shake us up, but no one's sanguine."
"Where's Joaquin? And where's Wyatt?"
"They're bringing the new boy along, together," Neither's been letting the other out of their sight.
Staff were making space in front of the entrance to the hall, preparing for Joaquin, the chair of the ambassadors, for Wyatt, the Bremen attaché, and for the new ambassador. There were people I didn't recognise. I'd lost sight of the pilot, so couldn't ask if they were crew, immigrants or temporaries. At most of these balls, the newly arrived, permanent or single tour, would be surrounded by locals. They wouldn't lack company, sexual or conversational. Their clothes and accoutrements, their augments, would be like grails. What wear they had would be pirated, and for weeks the local net would be twittering with exotic new algorithms. This time, no one cared about anything but the new ambassador.
What else arrived? Anything useful?
Ambassador Jasmine was in earshot, and I made a point of asking them rather than Edgar. Jasmine didn't like me, so I spoke to them when I could, to let them know they didn't intimidate me. They didn't answer, and I walked, greeted Simon, a security officer. We hadn't been close for years, but we liked each other sincerely enough that there was little awkwardness, though I was present as a guest, and an out-of-favour one at that, while he was working. He shook my hand with his bio-rigged right limb, which he'd worn since a gun had burst on a target range, and taken off his own flesh version. I went through the crowd, talked to friends, watching the glimmer of augments interact, hearing snatches of immer slang, and turning to the immersers who spoke them with a word or two in the same dialect, or a hand held in the finger lock that told them what ship I'd last served on, to their delight. I might touch their glasses, and I'd go on. Mostly, like everyone else, I was watching for the new ambassador. And then they came, in a moment that could only have been an anticlimax. It was Wyatt who opened the doors, more careful and hesitant than usual. Joaquin smiled beside him, and I admired how well they hid the anxiety they must have felt. Conversation hushed. I was holding my breath. There was some little commotion behind them, a moment of dispute between the figures who followed. The new ambassador stepped forward past their guides, into Diplomacy Hall. That was a palpable moment. One of the two men was tall and thin, with hair receding, a blinking, shyly smiling, sallow man. The other was stocky, muscular, and more than a hand shorter. He grinned. He was looking around. He ran his hand through his hair. He wore augments in his blood. I could see the shine of them around him. His companion seemed to have none. The shorter man had a Roman nose, the other a snub. Their skins were different colours, their eyes. They didn't look like or at each other. They stood, the new ambassador, smiling in their very different ways. They stood there moon-calf and quite impossible. Formally won. Kilo hours before, as we prepared for our travel, Sile came to some arrangement with his employers come supervisors. I never made much effort to understand his academic world. So far as I could gather, he had arranged a very extended sabbatical, and technically his residence in Embassy Town was part of a project minutely funded by his university. They were paying him a peppercorn retainer and keeping his access accounts live, with a view to ultimately publishing Forked Tongues, the socio-psycholinguistics of the Arieke. Researchers had come to Embassy Town before, particularly Bremen scientists fascinated by the host's biological contrivings. There were one or two still there, waiting for relief. But there hadn't been outsider linguists on Arieke in living memory, not since the pioneers who had striven to crack language nearly 3.5 mega-hours before.
"I can stand on their shoulders," Sile told me. "They had to work out how it worked from scratch. Why, we could understand the Arieke, but they couldn't understand us. Now we know that."
While we prepared to arrive in Embassy Town on what he called our honeymoon, Sile searched the libraries in Charu City. With my help, he tried to tap into Immersa lore about the place and its inhabitants. And finally, when we arrived, he hunted in our own archives in Embassy Town, but he'd found nothing systematic on his topic. That made him happy.
"Why has no one written on it before?" I asked him.
"No one comes here," he said. "It's too far. It's, no offence,
Stuck out in the middle of nowhere.
Lord, none taken.
And dangerous nowhere as well. Plus Bremen red tape. And to be honest, none of it makes much sense anyway.
The language?
Yes. Language.
Embassy Town had its own linguists, but most, Carter denied if they even bothered to apply, were scholars in the abstract. They learned and taught old and new French, Mandarin, Pan-Arabic, spoke them to each other as exercises, like others played chess. Some learned exot languages, to the extent that physiology allowed. The local Panagetch forgot their native languages when they learned our Anglo-Ubic, but 5 Kedis languages and 3 Shirazi dialects were spoken in Embassy Town, 4 and all of which respectively we could approximate. Local linguists didn't work on the language of the hosts. Sile, though, was unaffected by our taboos. He wasn't from Bremen, nor from any of its outposts, nor from another nation on Dagostein. Sile was from an urban moon, Sebastopolis, which I'd vaguely heard of. He grew up very polyglot. I was never quite sure which language, if any, he considered his first. While we travelled, I was envious of the blitheness, the sheer uninterest with which he ignored his birth home. Our route to Embassy Town was roundabout. The ships we took were crewed by immersers, from more places than I'd ever see. I knew the charts of Bremen's crowded Imma Cognita could once have told you the names of nations on many of its core worlds, and some of those I served with on my way home were from none of them. There were tear from regions so far off that they teased, telling me the name of their world was Fata Morgana, or Fiddler's Green. Had I ship-hopped in other directions, I could have gone to regions of Imma and every day where Bremen was the fable. People get lost in the overlapping sets of known space. Those who serve on exot vessels, who learn to withstand the strange strains of their propulsion, of swallow drives, overlight foldings, banshee tech, go even farther with less predictable trajectories, and become even more lost. It's been this way for mega hours, since women and men found the Imma and we became Homo diaspora. Sile's fascination with the host's language was always a bit of a titillation to me. I don't know if, as an outsider, not only to Embassy Town, but to Bremen space itself, he could appreciate the frisson he produced in me every time he said Arieke, instead of the respectful hosts, every time he passed their sentences and told me what they meant. I'm sure it's some kind of irony or something, that it was through my foreign husband's researches that I learnt most of what I know about the language of the city in a ghetto of which I was born. ACL, Accelerated Contact Linguistics, was, Sile told me, a speciality crossbred from pedagogics, receptivity, programming and cryptography. It was used by the scholar explorers of Bremen's pioneer ships to effect very fast communication with indigenes they encountered or which encountered them. In the logs of those early journeys, the excitement of the ACLers is moving. On continents, on worlds vivid and drab, they record first moments of understanding with menageries of exots. Tactile languages, bioluminescent words, all varieties of sounds that organisms can make. Dialects comprehensible only as palimpsests of references to everything already said, or in which adjectives are rude and verbs unholy. I've seen the trid diary of an ACLer barricaded in his cabin, whose vessel has been boarded by what we didn't then know as Corsicans. It was first contact. He's afraid, as he should be, of the huge things battering at his door, but he's recording his excitement at having just understood the tonal structures of their speech. When the ACLers and the crews came to Arieke, there started more than 250 kilo-hours of bewilderment. It wasn't that the host language is particularly difficult to understand, or changeable, or excessively various. There were startlingly few hosts on Arieke, scattered around the one city, and all spoke the same language. With the linguists' earware and drives, it wasn't hard to amass a database of sound words. The newcomers thought of them as words, though where they divided one from the next, the Arieke might not recognize fissures. The scholars made pretty quick sense of syntax. Like all exot languages, it had its share of astonishments. But there was nothing so alien that it trumped the ACLers or their machines. The hosts were patient, seemed intrigued by and,
insofar as anyone could tell through their polite opacity, welcoming to their guests. They had no access to Imma, nor exotic drives or even sublux engines. They never left their atmosphere, but they were otherwise advanced. They manipulated life with astonishing finesse, and they seemed unsurprised that there was sentience elsewhere. The hosts did not learn our Anglo-Ubic, did not seem to try, but within a few thousand hours, Tear linguists could understand much of what the hosts said, and synthesize responses and questions in the one Ariakin language. The phonetic structure of the sentences they had their machine speak, the tonal shifts, the vowels and the rhythm of consonants, were precise, accurate to the very limits of testing. The hosts listened and did not understand a single sound.
"How many of you get away?" Sile asked me.
"You make it sound like a prison break," I said.
"Well, come on. As I recall, you said to me more than once that you made it out.
As I recall, you may have told me that, you'd never go back."
He looked a sly look.
"Touché," I said. We were about to start on the last leg to Embassy Town.
"So, how many of you?"
"Not a whole lot. You mean immersers?"
"I mean anyone."
I shrugged. "A couple of non-immersers must get carters every so often. Not that many people bother applying, even if you do pass the tests."
"You in touch with any of your classmates?"
"Classmates? You mean the immersers in my batch, who left with me?"
"Hardly." I made finger motions to indicate our dispersal. "Anyway, there are only three others. We weren't close."
Even had the practicalities of my abhorred letters not made it near impossible, I wouldn't have tried, and nor would they. A classic unspoken agreement among escapees from a small town. Don't look back. Don't be each other's anchors. No nostalgia. I wasn't expecting any of them to return. On that journey to Embassy Town, Sile had had his soap oar amended, spiked with gerons, so he would age while under. It's an affecting gesture, to ensure that the sleep of travel doesn't keep you young while your working partner grows older. In fact, he didn't spend all his time under. With the help of medicines and augments, he spent a little of the journey awake and studying, where Imma allowed, breaking off to retch or fend off panic with chemical prophylactics as necessary.
"Listen to this," he read to me.
We were at the table, passing through very calm Imma shallows. In deference to his always sickness, I was eating dried-up fruit, a nearly odourless food.
"You are of course aware that every man has two mouths or voices. In this,"
he prodded what he was reading,
"they have sex by singing to each other."
It was some antique book about a flat land.
"What's the point of that nonsense?" I said.
"I'm looking for epigraphs," he said.
He tried other old stories, looking for invented cousins to the hosts. He showed me descriptions of Corians and Toucans, Ithorians, Weshar, invented double-tongued beasts. I couldn't share his enthusiasms for these grotesques.
"I could have Proverbs 5:4, he said, staring at his screen.
I didn't ask for an explanation. We used to joust like that sometimes. Instead, I uploaded a Bible when I was alone, to find. But in the end, she's bitter as wormwood, sharp as a sword with two mouths. The hosts aren't the only polyvocal exots. Apparently there are races who emit two, three, or countless sounds simultaneously to talk. The hosts, the Arieke, are comparatively simple. Their speech is an intertwining of two voices only, too complexly various to be pegged as bass or treble. Two sounds. They can't speak either voice singly, inextricable by the chance coevolution of a vocalizing ingestion mouth and what was once probably a specialized organ of alarm. The first ACLers listened and recorded and understood them.
"Today we heard them talk about a new building,"
the bewildered figures on the old trid told Sile and me.
"Today they were discussing their biowork. Today they were listing the names of stars."
We saw Yorick and Becca and their colleagues, neither of them yet famous at the time we spied on, mimicking the noises of the locals, repeating their sentences to them.
"We know that's a greeting. We know it is."
We watched a long dead linguist play sounds to awaiting Ariekis.
We know they can hear, she said. We know they understand by hearing each other. We know that if one of its friends said exactly what I just played, they'd understand each other.
Her recording shook its head at us, and Sile shook his. Of the epiphany itself, there's only Urik and Becca's written testimony. In the way of these things, others from their party later denounced the record as misrepresentative, but it was the Urik Becca manuscript that became the story. I'd seen the children's version long ago. I remembered the picture of the moment. Yorick's features a delight to the caricaturist. Him and subtler-faced Sura Becca, both rendered with pop-eyed exaggeration, staring at a host. I'd never read the Unbold the Rise manuscript till Sile pulled it up for me. We knew a great number of words and phrases, I read. We knew the most important greeting.
Jahl.
We heard it every day, and we repeated it every day, the latter without effect. We programmed our voxware and had it speak the word repeatedly. And repeatedly, the Arieke ignored it. At last, in frustration, we looked at each other and screamed half the word each, like a curse. By chance, they were simultaneous. Urik yelled, Suhail, Becca, Jar, at once. The Ariekis turned to us. It spoke. We didn't need our ware to make sense of what it said. It asked us who we were. It asked what we were and what we had said. It had not understood us, but it had known that there was something to understand. Before, it had always heard the synthesized voices just as noise. But this time, even though our shouts were much less accurate than any ware renditions, it knew that we had tried to speak. I've heard versions of that unlikely story many times. From that moment, or from whatever really happened, via misjudgments and wrong directions, within 75 kilo-hours, our predecessors understood the language's strange nature. Is it unique? I asked Sile once, and when he nodded I, for the first time, really felt astonishment at it, as if I were an outsider too. There's nothing like this anywhere, he said. Anywhere. It isn't about the sounds, you know. The sounds aren't where the meaning lives. There are exots who speak without speaking. There are no telepaths in this universe, I think. But there are empathics, with languages so silent that they may as well be sharing thoughts. The hosts are not like that. They're empaths of another kind. For humans, say red, and it's the re and the e and the de combined, those phonemes in context that communicate the colour. That's the case whether I say it, or Sile does, or a Shurasi, or a mindless program that has no sense that it's speaking at all. That is not how it is for the Ariake. Their language is organised noise, like all of ours are, but for them, each word is a funnel. Where to us each word means something, to the hosts, each is an opening, a door through which the thought of that referent, the thought itself that reached for that word, can be seen. If I program where with an Anglo-Ubic word and play it, you understand it, Sile said. If I do the same with a word in language and play it to an Ariekis, I understand it, but to them it means nothing, because it's only sound, and that's not where the meaning lives. It needs a mind behind it. Hosts' mind were inextricable from their doubled tongue. They couldn't learn other languages, couldn't conceive of their existence, or that the noises we made to each other were words at all. A host could understand nothing not spoken in language by a speaker with intent, with a mind behind the words. That was why those early ACL pioneers were confused. When their machines spoke, the hosts heard only empty barks. There's no other language that works like this, Sile said. The human voice can apprehend itself as the sounding of the soul itself.
Who was that? I said.
I could tell he was quoting.
I can't remember. Some philosopher. It's not true anyway, and he knew it.
Or she.
Or she. It's not true, not for the human voice, but the Ariake. When they speak, they do hear the soul in each voice. That's how the meaning lives there.
The words have got... He shook his head, hesitating, then just using that religiose term. Got the soul in them. And it has to be there, the meaning. Has to be true, to be language. That's why they make similes.
Like me, I said.
Like you, but not just like you. They made similes long before you lot ever touched down. With anything they could get their hands on. Animals, their wings. And that's what that split rock's for.
Split and fixed. That's the point.
Well, quite. They had to make it so they could say, it's like the rock which was split and fixed. About whatever it is they say that about.
But they didn't make as many similes, I thought, before us.
No, Sile said. That is, no.
I can think things which aren't there, I said. And so can they, obviously. They must, to plan the similes in the first place.
Not quite. They've no what-ifs, he said. At best, it must be like a pre-ghost in their heads. Everything in language is a truth claim, so they need the similes to compare things to make true things that aren't there yet, that they need to say. It might not be that they can think of it. Maybe language just demands it. That soul I was talking about is what they hear in ambassadors, too.
Linguists invented notation like musical score for the interwoven streams of host speak, named the two parts according to some lost reference, the cut and the turn voices. There, our human version of language was more flexible than the original of which it was a crude phonetic copy. It could be sounded out by where, it could be written, neither of which forms the hosts, for which language was speech spoken by a thinker thinking thoughts, could understand. We can't learn it, Sile said. All we can do is teach ourselves something with the same noises, which works quite differently. We jury-rigged a methodology, as we had to. Our minds aren't like theirs. We had to misunderstand language to learn it. When Urich and Becker spoke together with shared, intense feeling, one the cut and the other the turn, a flicker of meaning was transmitted, where zettabytes of wear had failed. Of course, they tried again, they and their colleagues practicing duets, words that meant hello or we would like to speak. We watched their recorded ghosts. We listened to them learn their lines.
Sounds flawless to me, said Sile, and even I recognized phrases, but the Arieke did not. You and B had no shared mind, Sile said, no coherent thoughts behind each word.
The hosts didn't react with quite the same blankness with which they had heard synthesized voices. They were uninterested in most, but listened hard to a few of these stuttering couples. They didn't understand it, but they seemed to know that something was being said. Linguists, singers, psychospecialists had investigated those pairs who had the most obvious impact. Scientists had striven to work out what they shared. That was how the Stadt-Dyadic empathy test was created. Attain a certain threshold together on its steep curve of mutual understandingness, fire up machines to connect various brainwaves, syncing and linking them, and a particular pair of humans might just be able to persuade the Ariake that there was meaning to their noises. Still, communication remained impossible for mega hours after contact. It was a long time after those early revelations that researchers into empathy got us anywhere. Very few pairs of people scored well on the Stadt scale, scored highly enough to mum a unified mind behind the language they ventriloquized. That was the minimum it would take to speak across the species. What the colony needed, someone had joked, were single people split in two. And to put it like that was to suggest a solution. The first interlocutors with the hosts were exhaustively trained monozygote twins. Few such siblings could make language work any better than the rest of us, but those that could were a slightly larger minority than in any control group. They spoke it horribly, we now know, and there were innumerable misunderstandings between them and the Arieke. But this meant trade, too, at last, and a struggling to learn. In my life, I'd met one other pair of idents, non-embassy town as I mean, in a port on Trione, a cold moon.
They were dancers. They did an act. They were bloodborn, of course, not made, but still. I was absolutely stunned by them, by how they looked like each other, but only so far. That their hair and clothes were not precisely the same, that they spoke in distinguishable voices, went to different parts of the room, talked to different people. On Arieka, for lifetimes, the last 2 mega hours, our representatives hadn't been twins, but doppels, cloned. It was the only viable way. They were bred in twos in the ambassador farm, tweaked to accentuate certain psychological qualities. Blood twins had long been outlawed. A limited empathy might be taught and drugged and tech-linked in between two people, but that wouldn't have been enough. The ambassadors were created and brought up to be one, with unified minds. They had the same genes, but much more. It was the minds those carefully nurtured genes made that the hosts could hear. If you raised them right, taught them to think of themselves right, wired them with links, then they could speak language with close enough to one sentience that the Arieke could understand it. The Stadt test was still taken in the out by students of the psyche and of languages. It had no practical use now, though. We grew our own ambassadors in Embassy Town and didn't have to find each precious potential one among very young twins. As a way to source speakers of language, the test was obsolete, I had thought. Latter Day 2.
Please join me.
I couldn't see who it was who spoke loudly, announcing the arrivals to Diplomacy Hall.
In welcoming Ambassador Ezra.
They were immediately surrounded. In that moment I saw no close friends, had no one with whom to share my tension or conspiratorial look. I waited for Ezra to do the rounds. When they did, how they did so was another indicator of their strangeness. They must have known how it would seem to us. As Joaquin and Wyatt introduced them to people, Ez and Ra separated, moved somewhat apart. They glanced at each other from time to time, like a couple, but there were soon meters between them. Nothing like doppels, nothing like an ambassador. Their links must work differently, I thought. I glanced at their little mechanisms. They each wore a distinct design. I shouldn't have been surprised. Disguising their unease with functionaries' aplomb, Joaquin led Ez and Wyatt Ra. Each half of the new ambassador was at the centre of a curious crowd. This was the first chance most of us had had to meet them. But there were staff and ambassadors whose fascination for the newcomers had clearly outlasted their own initial meetings. Lina, Randolph, and Henri were laughing with Ez, the shorter man, while Ra looked bashful as Andrew asked him questions, and Magdar, I realized, stayed close enough to touch his hands. The party bustled about me. I caught sight of Ursel's rendered eyes at last and winked as Ra approached me. Wyatt made an ah noise, held out his hands, kissed my cheeks.
Arvis. Ra, this is Arvis Benacho, one of Embassy Town's... Well, Arvis is any number of things.
He bowed as if granting me something.
She's one of our immersers. She spent a good deal of time in the out, and now she offers cosmopolitan expertise and an invaluable traveller's eye.
I liked Wyatt and his little power plays. You might say we tended to twinkle at each other. Ra, I said. A hesitation too short for him to notice, I think, and I held out my hand. I shouldn't call him Mr. or Squire. Legally, he was not a man, but half of something. Had he been with Ez, I'd have addressed them as ambassador. I nodded at Andrew, at Mag, at Dar, who watched.
Helmser Cho, Ra said quietly.
He, after his own hesitation, took my hand. I laughed. You've promoted me, and it's Arvis. Arvis is fine.
Arvis.
We stood silent for a moment. He was tall and slim, pale, his hair dark and plaited. He seemed slightly anxious, but he pulled himself together somewhat as we spoke.
I admire you being able to immerse, he said. I never get used to it. Not that I've travelled a lot, but that's partly why.
I forget what I replied, but whatever it was, there was a silence after it. After a minute I said to him, You'll have to get better at it, you know. Small talk. That's what your job is from here on in. He smiled.
I'm not sure that's quite fair, he said.
No, I said. There's wine to drink and papers to sign too. He seemed delighted by that. And for that you came all the way to Arieka, I said. Forever and ever.
Not forever, he said. We'll be here 70-80 kilo hours, until the next relief but one, I think. Then back to Bremen.
I was astounded. My blather stopped. Of course, I should not have been taken aback. An ambassador leaving embassy town. Nothing about this situation made sense. An ambassador with somewhere else to return to was a contradiction in my terms. Wyatt was muttering to Ra. Magdar smiled at me from behind them. I liked Magdar. They were one of the ambassadors who hadn't treated me differently since my falling out with Calvin.
I'm from Bremen, Ra told me. I'd like to travel like you have.
Are you cut or turn? I asked. It was obvious he didn't like the question.
Turn, he said.
He was older than I, but not by very much. How did all this happen? I said. You and Ez. It takes years. How long have you been training?
Are these really? Wyatt said from behind Ra. You'll hear all about that.
He raised his eyebrows in a rebuke, but I raised mine back. There was a moment between him and Ra before Ra spoke.
We'd been friends a long time, he said. We got tested years ago. Kilo hours, I mean. It was a random thing, part of an exhibition about the Stadt method.
He stopped as the noise in the room grew louder. Mag or Dar said something, laughing, moved between me and Ra, demanding the attention he politely turned on them. He's tense, I said to Wyatt quietly.
I don't think this is his favourite thing, he said. But then, would it be yours? Poor man's in a zoo.
Poor man, I said. Very, very strange to hear you speak of him like that.
Strange times.
We laughed over a swell of music. There was a strong smell of perfume and wine. We watched Ezra, who were not Ezra, not really, who were Ez and Ra, separated by meters. Ez was bantering with facility and pleasure. He caught my eye, excused himself to his interlocutors, and approached.
Hi, he said. I see you met my colleague.
He held out his hand. Your colleague? Yes, I met him. I shook my head. Joaquin were at Ez's elbows, one on each side like elderly parents, and I nodded at them. Your colleague. You really are just determined to scandalize us, Ez, I said.
Oh, please, no. Not at all, not at all.
He grinned an apology at the Doppels escorting him.
It's... well, I suppose it's just a slightly different way of doing things. And it'll be invaluable, said Hua,
or Keen, heartily. The two spoke in turn.
You're always telling us we're too stuck in our ways, Avis. This will be good for us, and good for Embassy Town.
One of them slapped Ez on the back.
Ambassador Ez Ra's an outstanding linguist and bureaucrat.
You're going to say they're a new broom, aren't you, Ambassador? I said. Joaquin laughed.
Why not? Why not indeed? That's exactly what they are.
We were rude, Ursel and I. We'd stick together, whispering and showing off at all these sorts of events. So when she waved a trid hand to attract my attention, I joined her, expecting to play. But when I reached her, she said to me urgently,
Sile's here.
I didn't look round. Are you sure? I never thought he'd come, she said. I said,
I don't know what.
It was some time since I'd seen my husband. I didn't want a scene. I bit a knuckle for a moment, stood up straighter. He's with Calvin, isn't he?
Am I going to have to separate you two girls?
It was Ez again. He made me start. He'd extricated himself from Joaquin's anxious stewarding. He offered me a drink. He flexed something inside himself, and his augments glimmered, changing the colour of his vague halo. I realised that with the help of his inner tech, he might have been listening to us. I focused on him and tried not to look facile. Ez was shorter than I, and muscular. His hair was cut close.
Ez, this is Ursel, I said.
To my astonishment, he looked at her, said nothing, and looked back at me. The rudeness made me gasp.
Having a good time,
he said to me. I watched tiny lights move across his corneas. Ursel was moving away. I was going to go with her and blank him haughtily, but behind his back she flashed a quick display. Stay. Learn.
You're going to have to do a lot better than that, I said to him quietly.
What?
He was startled.
What, you're...
She's not mine, I said. He stared at me.
The autumn? I apologize. I'm sorry.
It isn't me you owe that to. He inclined his head. What are you monitoring? I said to him after a silence. I can see your displays.
It's just habit. Temperature, air impurities, ambient noise. Mostly pointless. A few other things. I worked for years in situations that... Well, I got used to checking for TRID, cameras, ears, that sort of thing.
I raised an eyebrow.
And I tend to run translationware as a default.
No, I said. How exciting. Now, tell me the truth. Got wear in your ears? Are you running a soundtrack? He laughed.
No, he said. I grew out of that. I haven't done that for a good week or two.
Why are you running translation programs?
You...
I put my arm on his and looked suddenly exaggeratedly stricken.
You do speak language, don't you? Oh dear, there's been a terrible misunderstanding.
He laughed again.
Oh, I can get by in language. That's not it.
More seriously.
But I don't speak any of the Shirazi or Kedis dialects or...
Oh, you won't find exots here tonight, apart from mine host, obviously. I was surprised he didn't know this. Embassy Town was a Bremen colony, under Bremen laws that restricted our few exots to guest worker status.
What about you? He said. I don't see augments, so you speak language?
For a moment I really didn't understand what he meant. No. I let my sockets close up. I had a few bits and pieces once. They can be useful for immersion. And also, I said. Yes, you know, I can see how a bit to help make sense of what the hosts say is useful. But I've seen them. They're too... It's intrusive.
That's sort of the point, he said.
Right. And I can put up with that if it's any use. But language is beyond it, I said. Get them. When you hear a host speak, you get a whole eyeful or earful of nonsense. Hello, / query is all well, / inquiry after suitability of timing, / insinuations of warmness, 60% insinuations of belief, that interlocutor has topic to be discussed, 40%, blah, blah. I raised an eyebrow. It was pointless. Ez watched me. He knew I was lying. He must have known that the notion of using translationware for language would be, to an embassy towner, profoundly inappropriate. Not illegal, but an appalling impertinence. I didn't even know quite why I had said all that.
I've heard of you, he said.
I waited. If Ezra were even slightly good at their job, they'd have prepared something personal to say to most of the people they might meet tonight. What Ez said next, though, astonished me.
Ra reminded me where we'd heard your name. You're in a simile, aren't you? And I gather you've been to the city, outside Embassy Town.
Someone brushed past him. He didn't stop looking at me.
Yes, I said. I've been there.
I'm sorry. I think I've... Sorry if I've... It's not my business.
No, it's just... I'm surprised.
Of course I've heard of you. We do our research, you know. There's not many embassy towners who've done what you've done.
I didn't say anything. I felt I don't know what, to hear that I featured in the Bremen reports on Embassy Town. I inclined a glass at Ez, said some goodbye, and went to find Ursel manoeuvring her chassis through the crowd.
So, what's their story? I said.
Ursel gave her display shoulders a shrug.
Ez is a charmer, isn't he? She said.
Ra seems better, but he's shy. Anything online? She'd probably been trying to hack into data floating around.
Not much, she said.
It's some kind of coup for Wyatt that they're here. He's crowing so hard, hens everywhere are getting randy. That's why the staff are so tense. I decrypted the tail end of something. I'm pretty sure staff made Ezra sit a test. I suppose, you know, it's the first time in Christ knows how long there's been an ambassador from the out, and they queried whether anyone who didn't grow up speaking language could possibly get the nuances. They must resent this appointment.
They're all technically appointees too, don't forget, I said.
It was something that rankled with staff. On his arrival, Wyatt, like every attaché, had had to formally license all the ambassadors to speak for Bremen. Anyway, they can speak language, Ezra. She shrugged again.
Wouldn't be here if they'd failed, she said.
Something happened in the room. A feeling, a moment when, conviviality notwithstanding, it was suddenly imperative to focus. It was like that every time the hosts came into a room, as they had just come into Diplomacy Hall. The partygoers tried not to be rude, as if it were possible for us to be rude to them, as if the hosts considered politesse on axes that would make any sense to us. Nonetheless, most of us kept up our chit-chat and did not ogle. An exception was the crew, who stared frankly at the Arieke they had never seen before. Across the room I saw my helmsman, and I saw the expression on his face.